This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
And you're listening to Connecting Cultures Features on ORFM.
On Connecting Cultures Features today, we have Labour MP Priyanka Radhakrishnan, former Minister of Ethnic Communities and New Zealand's first Minister of Indian Origin. Priyanka is known for her advocacy for ethnic communities, migrant rights, and gender equality, and most recently, a bill to ban virginity testing. Kia ora, Priyanka. Glad to have you on the podcast today.
Kia ora, Aruna. Thank you for the opportunity to be on your podcast.
So today you'll be speaking to a lot of the Dunedin listeners, because that's where we are broadcasting on air today on Otago Access Radio. But we also have podcast listeners who's listening from all around the world. And on the show, we usually travel back with our guests to explore their lives before they become who they are today. So I wonder if you can tell us about your early life, and also where were you when you grew up?
Sure. So I was born in India, and my first migration experience was at the tender age of 3 months when I moved to Singapore, and that's where I grew up. I don't remember much of that experience, but I'm told that I cried for most of the plane ride over. Mm. But my parents were already working in Singapore. My mum went home for the delivery, so that's how I was born in India. But we also went back to India every year because my grandparents were there, and we spent school holidays at my grandparents' place, so that I had, I guess, an upbringing that reflected both the country that I grew up in, Singapore, which is pretty multicultural and all of that, but also I had a familiarity with India and with my extended family growing up as well. So yeah, and I mean, anyone who knows Singapore knows that it's a very safe, clean place to grow up. I was always a drama kid, so I did drama at school, and that was one of my highlights of my school years, and then got into debating as well at junior college level, which is just before tertiary. Studied media, mass communication, because I wanted initially to be a journalist. But then I ended up working in the women's rights space with an NGO in Singapore called AWARE. I was their comms person for a period of time, but they also ran a helpline that helped or supported women who'd been subjected to domestic violence. And actually, that's most of my work experience prior to entering Parliament.
Wow.
So that's my life in a nutshell.
Yeah, yeah, there's a lot there, and I'm excited to go deeper into the little points that you've shared. So it's been quite balanced growing up in Singapore, but also having that time to visit India. Can you tell us which part of India that your family's from?
Yeah, so my family's from a state called Kerala, which is on the southwest coast. But my grandparents, we used to stay with my maternal grandparents at the time. They're also from Kerala, but were living in Chennai at the time, which is in a neighboring state of Tamil Nadu. So I'm equally familiar, I guess, with both, but my mother tongue is Malayalam. We spoke Malayalam at home. But I also learnt Malay growing up in Singapore for many years, but both are a little bit rusty now, sadly.
I'm glad we share a language.
Yeah.
And so what was it like growing up in Singapore? I know that Singapore is a very multicultural country. Did you feel like you came from India, or that you just grew up normalizing who you are there?
Yeah, it's identity is such a funny thing, isn't it? It's different for everyone. For my family, because it was only ever the nuclear family in Singapore, it was only my parents, my sister and I. For my parents, they were always Indian, and Singapore was temporary because of work. But they lived there for over 30 years in the end before they moved back to India and I moved here. For me, till I moved, and I think maybe it was because of that, but till I moved to Aotearoa, New Zealand, my identity was very much Indian. So I grew up in Singapore my entire life till I was in my 20s and moved here. But I grew up in a household where we, you know, spoke English, but we also spoke our mother tongue. My parents were very immersed in Indian music. So I grew up with classical music, Indian music, food was very much, you know, simple Indian home-cooked meals. But you live, you're also, I've later realized, when I moved to New Zealand as an international student, I realized that I was a bit different. The students from India considered me quite different. So I wasn't sort of, you know, in their eyes, Indian. And so I think that's when I had to, or I came to the realization that as much as for 20 years of my life, or 20 odd years of my life, I considered myself Indian, and I am, but I'm also very much shaped by Singapore and the country, which is the country, of course, that I grew up in. I firmly believe that learning Bahasa Melayu allowed me to learn Te Reo Māori much more easily, for example, because the vowels and so on are quite similar, and consonants, really. I really miss Southeast Asian food. So I miss Malay food and just the mix of cuisines that you get in Singapore. And yeah, I think I'm a little bit of both, really. So I'm not 100% either, but it means that I'm really comfortable in various communities. One of the things that I feel very fondly about in terms of growing up in Singapore was that concept of open homes. And I'm not sure if that's the same in Malaysia. But for example, for Chinese New Year, we would go to our Chinese friends' homes. They would open up their homes. They would feed us. We would be part of their customs and traditions. And it was something as a child growing up that I never questioned. It was just so normal. And I would do that for Hari Raya with my Malay friends, you know, as well. And we were always embraced into their families. There was no question about difference. It was their cultures, while it wasn't my culture, it wasn't alien to me, you know, because I saw it in a home setting, not in a contrived sort of festival somewhere, which also has its place, but this was different. And I've often thought about that living in New Zealand, because we're so culturally diverse, ethnically, religiously diverse when it comes to languages here, I've never felt that, I don't know, I instinctively don't feel that othering of different cultures. And I think it's because of the way I was brought up and the society in which this was normalized.
A society that celebrated differences.
Yeah,
I'm glad you mentioned about open homes, because I didn't realize the word open homes meant something very different here. My co-workers thought I was selling my house when I invited them to my open house. so that's a very good point. Like, we're learning new things and they're learning new concepts as well.
But I'm just going to jump in here because your story reminded me of one. And again, in Singapore, we call it potluck, you know, and here it's bring a plate. And when I first moved to New Zealand, I took a plate to someone's house with no food on it. I was like, what is this new culture, new tradition? And then I realized it's just the same thing, but we call it a potluck.
Yeah. Oh, someone should really do a list of comparison between these cultures. It's really fascinating, the terms that we use. And so, yeah, I think it's really fascinating to know that it took you, like when you came to New Zealand, that's when you realized that, oh, you know, you are also influenced by your Singapore identity as much as your Indian identity. What made you come to New Zealand to study?
I had always been fascinated with New Zealand because I worked in the women's rights space and knew that women won the right to vote first in the Western world in New Zealand. That was always a draw card for me. Also, a friend of mine took me to watch one of the Lord of the Rings in the theatre in Singapore. I don't do nighttime movies. I still can't stay awake for movies that are very late. And this was a midnight showing. So I'm very ashamed to say that I slept through most of it. But I woke up at bits and I saw just the stunning scenery. And I remember thinking to myself, I must must go to New Zealand someday. It's just, it's so beautiful. The, you know, the scenery is just so stunning. I had also met Kiwis back in Singapore through my work, and always found them to be warm and welcoming. So I guess all of that together, plus the fact that my parents had moved back to India, I knew it was a matter of time before I moved away as well. And I wanted to experience something very different to Singapore, but I needed to finish my degree. So it had to be a Commonwealth country so I could cross credit. So a little bit of practical motivations, but also New Zealand in itself. And the third element was that I wanted to go somewhere where I didn't know anyone, so that I could, as much as possible, chart my own course, you know, without any fallback on family or friends. Half my class was in Australia and the other half was in Canada, so those were both out. So, yeah, just a mix of all of those reasons brought me to Palmerston North in the middle of winter, and that was my entry to Aotearoa, New Zealand.
Mm. So you came here as an international student. I wonder if you can share with us some challenges of navigating that, because it's quite interesting to hear that, you know, you are currently an MP and you've lived through something that I was once. I was an international student as well. So, yeah, what was that like for you?
So this is going back quite a few years now, over 20 years. But I guess I'm an optimist by nature, so I never thought that it would be anything other than fine, you know. I did a fair bit of research into New Zealand universities, where I wanted to go, and so I chose Palmerston North because I felt that it would be as different to a city like Singapore as possible. So I came here, bearing in mind Singapore is always about 32 degrees and very humid, and came here to the middle of, you know, to Palmerston North in the middle of winter. So that was a little bit of a, it was a bit interesting, but I loved it. Loved winters, loved the cold, loved meeting new people. Of course, experienced the moments of missing home and missing family and feeling like you never quite fit anywhere. Had a very jarring experience when, because I stayed on campus for the first 6 months when I moved here. And I thought I'd go to the supermarket and pick up some groceries to keep in my dorm, in my hostel, whatever. And then I had two experiences that were interesting. So went to the supermarket, decided that I'd take the bus back to campus, and was followed by a random stranger who made me feel very uncomfortable. And at that point, I realized that no one had actually told me what the number was to call the police in New Zealand, and that would be quite, you know, potentially a different number to what you're used to back home. But that was all right. I decided to jump into a cab, and then realized how expensive taxis are compared to back home. So a few different things, you know, some, I guess, a bit more lighthearted, some a little bit more serious in terms of just navigating a new country. And then there was the time where I was asked to bring a plate. And in my first couple of days, I remember walking out of the hall and a few others walking into the hall that we stayed at. And this was probably the second day after I moved to New Zealand. And they said to me, "Oh, we're just going to tea. Would you like to join us?" And I thought, "Oh, yeah, it's about 6:30. It's time for a cup of tea and a biscuit." And I went with them and then realized that they were talking about dinner. There was this full spread of food and meat and vegetables, and it was not the tea time that we used to back in, you know, either Singapore or India, frankly. So just some little things to get used to, I guess, coming to a different culture and a different country. But by and large, I found New Zealanders really helpful. I have no direction sense, so I was often lost. And people would often stop and ask you if you needed some help, and things like that. So, yeah, it was an interesting experience, but never regretted it.
You've had a lot of reflections about your student time. I feel good that you are, you know, you're more settled now after 20 years in Aotearoa. Were there any cultural values that your parents have taught you that shape you to who you are today?
Yeah, I think a lot of who I am today, I guess both my personality, but more importantly, my values were ones that were shaped by my parents. My parents were, you know, the quintessential migrant family. They were hardworking. So my work ethic was shaped by seeing them. The other aspect that I've reflected on more recently is the importance of volunteering. It's something that I feel very strongly about. I was for a period of time, well, actually in the last term, Minister for the Community and Voluntary Sector. And that's when I reflected on why I feel volunteering is so important for us as a society. And I believe that stems from seeing both my parents volunteer on the weekends at various causes, either at the temple that we used to go to, or my dad used to teach boys at an orphanage maths and physics, I think it was at the time. So, so that's something that's been shaped by my parents. My parents and my extended family more broadly have always been political, not party political, but political in the sense of discussing issues and the status quo and what needs to change and why. So I've been brought up in a family where that was always encouraged, where critical thinking was encouraged. Also, values like honesty and integrity were ones that my parents instilled in me from when we were children as well. So I do think that a lot of who I am, plus my focus on social justice, that is what motivates me to do virtually everything that I've done, whether it's prior to Parliament or now in Parliament. And I'll share a very quick story. When I was about 9 years old, I went with my parents to a hospital in Singapore, and we went to visit this man whose story had been in the newspaper, which is how my parents found out about him. He had come to Singapore from Bangladesh as a construction worker, and he had been promised accommodation in Singapore, better wages. He had a young wife and a child back home in Bangladesh, and his plan was to move to Singapore, work, earn some money, and bring them over. We visited him in hospital because he had fallen off scaffolding on the construction site, and he had broken, I think it was an arm and a leg. And he told us his story. And I remember this as a child, just sitting there. The conversation was between my parents and him. But he told us how he had come to Singapore with all these hopes as a migrant worker, but had been put into a house that had 6 beds and 12 people living there, which meant that if one of them fell ill, there was no bed because they slept in shifts because they were shift workers. Now that he was in hospital, his employer wasn't going to help pay his hospital bills. He was earning less than he thought he would earn when he moved to Singapore. So he couldn't afford to pay his bill, and he couldn't afford to go back to Bangladesh or to bring his family. So he was stuck. And the newspaper article my parents had read was an appeal to help him. And so that we had gone, my parents had said, we'll like to help, but we want to meet him first before we help him with his expenses and so on and so forth. So, you know, they weren't rich, but whatever they had, they shared with others. But that story made me think about how poverty exists, even in countries that seem wealthy, where there's always different classes of people. And the way some countries, many countries, treat migrant workers, you know, all of that didn't occur to me when I was 9 years old, but it's a story that's stuck with me, and I've reflected on when it comes to my politics and why I do any of the work that I do. And I was only there because my parents took me. So
your parents have been a really great influence for your political journey. A really good segue to talk about your politics pathway. You wanted to be a journalist growing up. How did that come into politics? Do you see that coming together quite nicely as well?
Oh, I didn't really, because I didn't actually end up being a journalist, to be completely honest. I think part of that was because I wanted to travel the world and write. I liked to write, and I thought it was a good way to travel the world. But anyway, my life kind of took a different path. I went down the sort of the communications route to the NGO sector, and that's the sector I've worked in. But I kind of, again, took a little bit of a turn, I guess, towards social work rather than journalism. So that's largely been my background prior to entering Parliament. But I will say that a background in communications is not a bad thing for a politician, because I write articles for some community newspapers, for example. A lot of our role is public speaking. And that's something I've had to hone over the years. But media gives you a little bit of a background when it comes to asking questions and answering them. On this side, we're answering them. So yeah, I'm sure it has played a role. Plus drama and debating that I've done through school is helpful as well, given the amount of public speaking we do. So I guess to an extent it has.
So you've got skills from all these little things, including, you know, theatre and drama from back then. Yeah. Were there any people that you get inspired by as you were trying to choose a career, especially, you know, thinking about the younger generation who might not know where they might go in the future?
Yeah, I often find inspiration in just normal people who are doing extraordinary things, and you see them all around you. You know, I've seen them in the various spaces that I've worked. I know I've already talked a lot about my parents, but they were probably my first source of inspiration. Looking back, particularly, my mother was a hardcore feminist. So everything that I value when it comes to women's rights, I have seen her live that out. Working with people like, so I worked for a time with Phil Goff before he became the mayor of Auckland. I have never seen someone who works as hard as that man. He literally would be in the office well before anyone else at like 7 o'clock in the morning and worked late into the night. So I've picked up, I think, various aspects of inspiration from people. I think working with Jacinda when she was prime minister and in her cabinet will always be a highlight of my life. When you say, who do you look to for inspiration for a career? I always find that I've been asked that a lot, and I find that always a little bit difficult to answer, because a career in politics is not something I picked, frankly. I thought that I would always work in the NGO space, perhaps. It was, you know, a space that I enjoyed working in. I got a lot of fulfillment in. Politics kind of happened accidentally, to be completely honest. It's not something I charted for myself. But working with Shakti, which is the organization I worked for many years before entering Parliament, and I know they have a presence in Otipoti, Dunedin as well, I did the crisis casework. I did the building up of the particular refuge in Tauranga. That's what I was hired for. Worked with the team to set up the first ethnic women's refuge there. But part of my role was also lobbying successive governments for legislative and policy change. So that was how I found out or learned about the political system in New Zealand. I joined the Labour Party because my boss at the time was running for Parliament, to be honest, and she got me involved in her campaign. But I stayed because the values of the party reflected my own. Never once thought of running for Parliament, though. Not because I thought I couldn't do it, but it just never occurred to me. I did everything else that people did behind the scenes. I volunteered. Helen Clark was Prime Minister when I joined the Labour Party. Really liked what the party had done and was doing for migrant communities. So I stayed and worked behind the scenes. It was only when I did my master's at Vic that, to cut a long story short, I happened to be doing a paper with someone who had been a senior former cabinet minister and was exiting Parliament at the time. At the end of the course, he hosted our group in Parliament, and we walked past the debating chamber, and I remember saying to no one in particular, I said, I want to speak here. And he took me aside and he said, I heard what you said. You've been a member for a long time. You've been knocking on the doors for change from the NGO sector for years. Why don't you try and be at the table? And that appealed to me. And so I thought, yeah, I'd give that a go. And he said, if you decide to stand, I'll mentor you. And he did. And then he introduced me at that time to someone who was at the tail end of her first term in Parliament. He was leaving Parliament, so he said, you take over and mentor her. And that was Jacinda. She ended up being my boss as well. So it kind of just, I think so much about politics is seizing the opportunity. So you may not plan, and this would probably hold true for most things in life. You know, I think it, for young people, my message has always been to examine your values, to work out what it is that drives you. What do you feel passionately about, you know, and follow that. Find people who have made change in that area as your inspiration. I'm a huge believer in mentorship. So ask someone to be your mentor if they don't just offer, and then chart your course that way. But I think if you fall back on what makes you tick and what your values are, then you'll never go wrong.
That's really good advice. I'm really happy to hear your story being at the debating chamber and saying that, you know, just unconsciously and suddenly you're there, you know. Yeah. And what I understand from your story, it's just like you've been saying yes and just following the flow, and you met the right people, and yeah, you've got really good mentors. So that's...
Yeah, to an extent, but I will also... I wouldn't want to underscore the importance of hard work. It doesn't just always map out magically because you've thought about it, you know, like between that flippant throwaway comment outside the debating chamber, which would have been in 2010 or 2011, and getting in 2017, there was a hard slog as well. So, yeah, so anything I think that you want hard enough, yes, for me, I've always said yes to opportunities. I've tried to find people who can help me along the way, because none of us achieve anything alone. It's always through the support of others, I believe, and I've experienced. But I think you've also got to work for it.
And throughout your time, what have been some of your proudest moments? And I do want to mention that, you know, you were the first minister of Indian origin in New Zealand. I think that's a really inspiring thing to be known for. Is there anything that really, you know, made you think at night, like, oh, you feel proud of what you've done?
I mean, I'm still in it, so it's a bit hard to be objective about your time in politics when you're still, you know, sort of fighting every day, particularly now in the opposition benches. Also, I cannot take any credit for being the first Minister of Indian Origin. That was all thanks to the boss who appointed me minister, who at the time didn't realize that I would be the first Minister of Indian Origin. Neither of us did, to be honest, until a journalist asked the question. And then we looked at each other and we were like, yeah, that's probably true, actually. So that kind of happened. But I do believe that it's that you can't be what you can't see. So I have heard from a number of young women, particularly of colour from different ethnic communities, who now feel that that is achievable because someone's done it, you know. So in as much as that helps others, great. Not necessarily an achievement of mine per se, though. But being minister was a huge privilege. There are not very many of us at any given point in time. And I think when you're the first of anything, you reflect on how you don't screw it up for everyone else who's coming later. So you kind of, you want to do a good job anyway, but there's even more of an impetus to do a good job, because otherwise, you know, it's everyone else who's going to wear that. So I was acutely mindful of that, I guess. Our government set up the first ministry for ethnic communities, which I believe has done a lot of good and will continue to do a lot of good in that space. That came out of one of the recommendations of the Royal Commission of Inquiry into the mosque attacks. But it's also something that our communities fought for many years. So I think that was pretty good. I got to lead some of the work looking at what social cohesion means for New Zealand, again, in direct response to the Royal Commission recommendations. And we did that with Te Tiriti as the base and through a wānanga style of trying to get meaningful input from different sectors of society, and came up with agreed definition of social cohesion for Aotearoa New Zealand. And I was quite proud of the process that we got to do. And it wasn't just me, it was a number of officials from MSD who also felt strongly about this piece of work. But it led to then looking at how government could make decisions differently with social cohesion at the heart of it. But unfortunately, there was an election in 2023, and I'm not too sure that that work has progressed under this government, frankly. So a few things there. I'm proud of a lot of work that our government did in that time, you know, that I may not have been specifically responsible for, but inadvertently was by virtue of being part of cabinet. So yeah, I'm sure I'll continue to reflect on some of that.
I think you'll be quite surprised by this question, but it is a personal interest of mine to ask our guests to tell us like how they personally care for their well-being. And I think, you know, you're a very busy woman, I'm sure. What are things you do for yourself, practical things you might do for yourself as you juggle everything else?
Yeah, that's a great question, actually. So go you for asking all your guests. And I'd be keen to hear what some of the others said. But for me, I'm increasingly of the view that that shouldn't be by the by. You know, it is important. Sure, we're all busy. We're all different levels of busy. I'm less busy now, frankly, than I was when I was a minister, because when you're a minister and you feel strongly about the access that people have to politicians and democracy, you then get out as much as you can. And I tried to get out to as many events and things that I could get to so that people were able to engage with me on what's working and what's not working. But equally, so I would do that, you know, you're in Parliament most of the week, you'd do that on Fridays and Saturdays. I had an electorate at the time as well, so I had to get out into the electorate and meet with constituents, so tried to juggle all of that. And on Sundays was my reading day, because we used to get, ministers get this thing called a weekend bag, and it sounds innocuous and it sounds really lovely, but it's actually a briefcase, either physical or folders, if you're digital like I was, that has anywhere between 40 to 70 briefings just for the week ahead. So it's all your cabinet papers, it's all your officials' meetings and papers for that. You have to read all of that if you're going to contribute effectively. So my entire Sunday from morning to evening would be reading my papers. And then in the evening, I would call my dad, something that I still do every Sunday. He lives in India. And then I would have a few hours to unwind and pack for the next day. So there wasn't a lot of opportunity to juggle anything else from a well-being point of view at that time. But I would carve out some space and tried to exercise. I try and exercise every day. I'm often not successful, but I try. And nowadays, I have got a yoga mat in my office. I do yoga, and I find that that helps both my physical and emotional well-being. So sometimes in between sessions in Parliament, I will just do a quick yoga session in my office. And I've done that consistently. I have three rescue dogs. And I try and carve out some time to spend with them and my husband, but, you know, the rescue dog, and go for walks and things like that. Sundays now, because I don't have all those cabinet papers to read, I try and guard as fiercely as possible. I get a lot of flack for not attending events on Sundays sometimes, but that is my time. And as much as possible, I have one day for my family and for my mental well-being, and I'm fiercely protective of it. So I start off with an hour-long yoga session. I then carve out some time to read something for fun. I love to read. for 3 years as a minister, I didn't read one thing for pleasure because there was so much of reading for work, which I'm not begrudging. I loved it, but, you know, it was just how it was. So now I'm trying to catch up and make up for lost time. I go for a walk and I have a bath in the evenings on Sundays. So those are just a few things that I do for myself, and I feel it sets me up for the week ahead as well.
It's so important that you blocked off your Sundays. So yeah, it's important. I'm sure that it really sets you up for the rest of the week as well as a reset. Having a yoga mat at the office is probably the best tip because you can just, you know, rest whenever you need to. And I think I can relate to that as a Muslim because we have to pray 5 times a day. So we get that, you know, important time where we are forced to take a break from the real life. One last question I have for you is, what are you most excited for in life? And it can be something that's coming up soon, you know, next year in the future. But what's keeping you going at the moment?
The election next year. And the opportunity to change the government. But that's definitely something that consumes me at the moment, if I'm completely honest, because in every space that I hold as a shadow portfolio, I'm the opposition spokesperson for disability issues, conservation, and the New Zealand security agencies, so the NZSIS and the GCSB. And in all spaces, but probably predominantly disability issues and conservation, we've seen what I feel is us going backwards as a society, you know, and I feel there's so much change that would be positive to people's lives and to te tayo, to the environment, to nature, that we could be doing. And so I'm currently in the process. Our role as opposition members of parliament is, and this is my first stint in opposition, so it's been an interesting year and a half. It's twofold. Part of it is to hold the government to account, but the other part of it is policy development in the lead up to next year's election. So I've been out talking to people about what positive change could look like in these spaces. And I'm at the point in the electoral cycle now where we're drafting all of that up. We've got internal processes going on as well. So I think the prospect, always the prospect of change is what keeps me going, you know, whether you're in government or you're in opposition, the opportunity to make change is a privilege. And I'm in a position to be able to advocate for some of that at a level where you can affect change on a large scale. And that's not one that I take lightly. It does consume most of my waking days and, you know, my time. But it continues to excite me.
And being hopeful for change is something that a lot of us are feeling right now. And hopefully they can feel that way after hearing your interview. So thank you so much, Priyanka. I'm really glad we had this chat today. I love hearing your personal story. I think this is a really fun interview that we have today. All the best. And I'm sure we'll have more catch-ups in the future about other things.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's, honestly, it's been like a bit of a chat with a friend and we've only just met. So thank you for the opportunity for this and for making it both an opportunity to reflect, but also just to have a conversation. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Connecting Cultures Features on RFM.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.